Well, I think we should get underway. Some members have informed me that they have travel or other commitments which will require them to leave as soon as the meeting is over, which means to have maximum value of their presence, we need to sort of stick to schedule as best we can. And I think we are pretty much on track. But we should turn now to hear back from the various discussion groups on the disclosure question. My sense is we've hit quite a nerve in terms of a topic that we care about. So perhaps we'll take them in numerical order, if we will, please. Jeff, would you mind leading off?
Thank you, Paul. The first question, how helpful did you find the various reports and what are the main messages for the ISB from those reports? We took each report separately. And so starting with the first report, the losing the excess baggage report, we actually voted on a scale of 1 to 3 for each of the reports with... with 3 being very helpful, 1 not so helpful, and 2 in between. So for the first report, excess baggage report, the vote was, if I added correctly, very helpful, there was 4, helpful, there was 5, and not helpful, there was 2. Some of the comments were that several felt that the report was helpful in providing one view on how you may reduce the volume of disclosures. However, some of the concerns raised were that the report focused too much on reducing the volume, and there wasn't enough emphasis on enhancing the clarity. There was also the comment made that it didn't have the right starting point, which should be first evaluating what the user needs are and then going from there. Also, comments were made that they found the basis for the various decision points in the model in need of some strengthening to give the ISB an approach that they could use going forward. So turning to the second report, the UK FRC report, Cutting the Clutter, believe it or not, again, if I added correctly, we had exactly the same voting results. We had 4 very helpful, 5 helpful, and 2 not helpful. Connection with this report, comments included that it was helpful in defining the term clutter. Some thought that was quite helpful. Also, the notion of describing the behavioral influences on disclosure overload was found by a number of the members to be quite helpful. Again, there was a concern that there wasn't enough of a user focus in this model as well. There was some disagreement with some of the examples of clutter. One mentioned the governance area, another about the explanatory material that not necessarily in all cases would those areas be considered areas of clutter, particularly to some in the investor community. So that takes us to the third report on simplifying accounting obligations. Here we ended up unanimous where everyone ended up on voting 1 for this report. And the reason was that the group believed that once you're a listed company, that you receive certain benefits from being listed and you have certain obligations as well. And one of those obligations is to provide the disclosures that are required of all listed companies. We acknowledge that there may be multi-tiers in certain exchanges and that in that case, the exchanges and or the regulators may reduce the disclosures in some of the lower tiers in those exchanges. But in that case, we really thought the decision to do that is one with the exchanges and the regulators, not with the IESB. So at that point, I declared victory and told everyone we could go to lunch. And then I was reminded that we had two other issues to discuss. So I then went to the next issue, which was what short-term fixes the IFRS do you think are most likely to address concerns about clarity and length of financial reports? We thought that the suggestions that were listed for possible short-term fixes, they all had some merit, however, not in a short-term fix. We felt that each of those items should be considered as part of a broader-based disclosure framework project. The most difficult of the various suggestions that was mentioned, which we had quite a few different opinions on, related to guidance on how to assess materiality, with the recognition that that's a very difficult and of the items listed, that may be more the most difficult one to resolve, and we had different viewpoints on how that might be done, but we certainly agreed that it wouldn't be easy. Final issue, should the ISB bring together regulators, auditors, investors, peers, assess strategies for improving the quality of financial reports? Everyone said yes. Have suggestions about what you think is the best way to do this. Our approach would be first to collect and analyze all of the research that is already out there. There were a number of different examples that were referenced by members pointing to research by various groups, World Bank, Financial Stability Forum, a number of individual companies that have done work on improving their disclosures. We also understand there's a lot of academic research in the area of disclosures. So first step is to identify, collect, and analyze the research. Second step would then be to pull together all of the interested parties. Again, it's critical that there be active user involvement. And part of the discussion should be what we can do under the existing framework, under the existing concepts to improve disclosures, the clarity, and reduce the length of disclosures, but then get into the discussion of what we need to change to the framework, what needs to be added to the framework in order to improve the clarity and reduce unnecessary length in the disclosures. So after pulling together this group, we would expect some proposals would be developed out of the group, and then there would be some level of consultation and obtaining feedback on those proposals. And then at that point, I think the best ideas that have gone through that process and that feedback process would then be fed into the ISB's disclosure framework project. So that concludes group one. I'm sure I've missed some important details, and I invite my fellow members of the group to make corrections or additions to the record. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Any comments, questions? All right, well then, let's turn next to Jerry. Are you ready?
Thank you, Paul. As usual, I beg your pardon? Yeah. As usual, as usual, there are significant overlaps, as one might expect. We did not go through the voting process on the reports. In fact, we did think they were helpful. But we thought they were helpful by, number one, the fact that so many major projects were underway demonstrates that indeed there's a huge need. But we also felt that the reports taken together demonstrate the complexity of the challenge that's faced, and the fact that therefore what is needed is to deal with disclosure in a structured, holistic, and systematic way. We thought that that one of the key challenges that would be faced was to define the users that we're trying to serve. There we discussed principally investors, equity, debt, hybrid. We also discussed regulators, rating agency, and others, even though they often have access to private data, but nevertheless are stakeholders in this process. We spent a lot of time talking about the fact that disclosure is much more than notes, and we also discussed the regional difference between emerging markets. We heard from Brazil and India, as well as Europe and the U.S. So if you're focusing on global disclosure, some of the things such as MD&A used in many parts of the world, director's report, press releases, supplemental reports, this is a huge area, and we're talking about the notes. And so for notes, we spent some time talking about what definitional clarity was required, and principally we focused in on relevance and materiality as crying out for some kind of tighter definition. We agreed with the first group in that I think one of our members said it best, that once you've accessed the capital markets, you've taken on a responsibility for disclosure, and you have an obligation to do so, and therefore there was a sense that there should not be differentiation between issuers. We believed that we needed to decide on the role of the notes, and we talked about the forward-looking issues and looking historically and variance analysis, et cetera. One of our members, actually it was Christoph, came up with what was, I think everybody in the group thought was a pretty creative way to distinguish the roles that we think that the board's got to decide which one or some combination of these notes are going to be. And that's a dictionary where you go in for specific places for facts to understand what's happening, versus a novel where, as was commented, you could cut out three of the boring pages in the middle and not miss anything, because what you really want to do is turn to the end to find the conclusion. We did not come to an answer as to whether this is a novel or a dictionary, but there was a conceptual framework there that we felt it was important for the board to decide what's the role, and especially in the midst of all these other forms of disclosure that are also happening. We believe that they should be all-encompassing, and of course should explain the movements, principal role movements in the balance sheet and P&L. We saw the disclosure as part of the conceptual framework and therefore strategic, not tactical. This will explain some of the stuff that we say later. We believe that there should be a disclosure statement for each standard. We believe that that one of the reports demonstrated so clearly that we need to recognize behavior, that this isn't just a technical exercise. And finally, there was quite a bit of belief that the bar should be higher in terms of including new notes and lower in terms of taking them out. Jumping to the second question, I guess the short answer was we don't believe that the short-term fixes are the way to go. We believe it's a holistic problem. We don't believe that the short-term fixes fit the IASB due process framework, and that indeed, as was commented, some of the short-term fixes have turned into long-term ones. The concern was expressed that they would be a diversion of energy, and that in fact we ought to just get on with the job of putting a framework in place. Finally, the answer was yes. As the last group, again, holistic process, overall disclosure environment, would apply the formal due process of the IASB to this activity. Interactive collaboration, I know that I'm gonna get a laugh because users were actually the first one we had in our minds, and I started with prepare, so I guess I apologize for that bias. But we would include users, preparers, auditors, regulators, and very much along the line that's best been discussed. We believe that roundtables are important, and we recommended the formation of a working group. I know there's a formal process at the ISB for that, but you're pulling together a group of people who aren't naturally part of a working group within this body, and we felt a working group was important. The one specific comment that was made that demonstrates the challenge, Jim, I guess your name came up in our conversation at this point, and that is some of the contradiction that exists in the notes between the issue of materiality and the fact that in some audit cases, you're required to bring non-trivial items into the notes, and as a result, you end up with something that just doesn't adhere to a standard of materiality. That is, those are my notes to the best I have them. I would ask my team members for any clarifications or additions.
Thanks, Jerry. Any clarifications, comments, questions? All right, April.
Thank you. Jerry, I'm very jealous about the slides. Jerry and I joked about this yesterday, and I thought he was saying, oh, no, can't do slides. It's lunchtime. How are we going to do this? But, you know. But I'm told from one or two of your teammates that you did those yesterday. Paul, much of what we discussed in Group 3, we have heard reflected from both of the groups so far. So I will, in the interest of your timing, travel at a fairly high level. We too recognised a high degree of consensus around that there is a problem to be tackled, as reflected by a number of reports. Exactly what that problem is, we didn't discuss, but that there's a high degree of consensus and that the ISB should take a coordination and leadership role in this project, that it should be a priority project of a medium-term length. It's a serious project, so it's that idea of not a quick fix came through, but it also is a priority. So start now. The project was the framework project. That term kept coming through in all of the discussion, identifying some of the matters that have been already mentioned, so I won't explain them, I'll just list them. Materiality, relevance, huge emphasis on quality of disclosures, not quantity of disclosure, recognising the range of users that these financial statements were for. We talked about that disclosure isn't just financial statements or isn't just notes, it has to be taken in the broader context, and Jerry's slide identified a number of those other disclosure issues. We talked about placement, recognised the behavioural aspect of this project or the behavioural tensions inside the problem, and identification of essential elements. So those are some of the things you'd want to touch on in the framework. Although we should also not... And we only got a summary from Isabel, we know, but we thought it was perhaps a little simplistic to say that because of the increase in quantity that we had a problem, that, you know, business is more complex than it was 10, 20 years ago, and therefore there is more things that we need to know about complex transactions and instruments. So to be aware that it's quality, not quantity. Timing-wise, we recognise a tension between the time it would take to develop a framework and the disclosure problem that we hear now, people concerned about that, and I'll touch on that in question two. We re-emphasise the behavioural issues, the concerns about reading things legally, the behaviour of preparers, auditors, regulators, and how they interact, and the inclination of standard setters to add rather than remove. Perhaps we said that some of those things, though, would have to be tackled at a national or local level because the IASB was just one part of the behavioural aspect there, although we thought the problem should be tackled, the framework should be developed at a global level. We thought it was important to draw on all the evidence from the reports, and like the other groups, we were not supportive of a split in the disclosure requirements for listed entities. Once you were listed, unless there was, as Jeff mentioned, there was some other defining characteristic at a local level that was already there. So that was question number one, which clearly fed into the answer to question number two about the quick fixes. We said that it really wasn't a quick fix, but at the same token, not to start from scratch, to start with the existing projects, recognise all the work that had already been done. It's a high priority. Focus on the relevance of the information. It must take a principled common ground approach, but start immediately. Very conscious about the standards, the big four standards that are right in the process of being completed, and that perhaps we can be very conscious, the ISB could be very conscious of this on this disclosure issue and problem in developing those existing standards, and when it actually looks at the disclosures in those four standards, that it basically double checks. It takes a pause and thinks, well, we don't know what a framework would look like, but we need to make double sure that we don't, that when we word this, that we take into consideration a number of the things that have been identified: materiality, relevance, quality. And you might then also, as the project is being developed, as the framework is developed, test it against some of the critical existing standards as you go. And after the group had finished, someone suggested, you know, that as the framework project was developing, you could test it against IFRS's 2, 7 and 36, and so that you get an aspect of the now, the standards that are causing disclosure problems now, instead of waiting for the framework to be completed and then gone through. So that was a suggestion that came after, hadn't been run past the whole group. Three, on the focus group, yes, we said yes, as you'd expect, that you would use a focus group or some form of meeting, drawing from those who have already who have been involved in these existing projects that we've heard about this morning. Do that sooner rather than later. Try and avoid it being a talk fest. And one of the ideas that was put forward was even that ISB staff could provide a provocative general idea of what a framework might be. So one that hasn't necessarily been to the board, but, you know, here's an outline of a framework, and that would get reactions. But that in and of itself wasn't going to be enough, that individual groups of stakeholders also needed to do work on this area, and that was really acknowledging that one of the key factors in this problem is behaviour. What's driving the preparers to repeat information that some might be considered as just boilerplate and adding no value? What's driving the auditors? What's driving the regulator? And that the stakeholders needed to look at their own role and their own behaviour, but also be open for the need to change their behaviour, not just hope that others will solve the problem. That was the summary, as I heard it from group three. If anyone wanted to add.
Thank you, April. Any supplemental comments or questions of April? All right, then let's move to the fourth. Richard was the discussion. I was in this group. He repeatedly reminded us that he's no longer a securities regulator.
Yes.
Seemed quite happy about that.
Yes. Well, insurance is more exciting. I felt pretty good before lunch. I thought.
Yeah.
I thought last on, all I have to do is agree with everyone else, and now no slides, no voting. Incoherent discussion and an overwhelming sense of inadequacy, I'm afraid. But never mind, I'll get over it. We focused on the two issues. Are there any quick wins for the ISB, and what should the ISB do next? On the quick wins, we didn't think there were very many. We looked at We considered this issue in the context of materiality, the relevance, and communications. And on communications, noted especially that with more electronic communicating, there is less pressure than there was on resolving disclosure issues, but they're still highly relevant. The materiality versus relevance, we were looking here at nil balances being material just as much as large balances, if they are relevant, that having no exposure to something can be highly relevant and therefore it should still be disclosed. And we thought in particular there was value in accelerating work on materiality for the ISB as the beginning of a project on disclosures more widely. That would address the interaction between the materiality in the financial statements themselves versus the materiality in the notes, and would also help with those considerations of where relevance is a bigger issue. And clearly any work to be done in those areas should be done with the IAASB. More than one person said that they felt that the ESMA work was actually unhelpful, that it was not helpful for securities regulators to be engaged in this, and this was more one for the accounting standards setters. There was also a debate about whether some of the proposals in the ICAS paper could be accelerated, notably the proposals on reducing the number of reconciliations and comparatives. There might be value in that. Others said that it's always dangerous to pick out things and say they can be fixed quickly because often they actually reveal deeper problems that haven't really been considered. Like others, we thought that this was largely an issue about behaviour. It's not entirely one for the accounting standards setters to fix, that preparers get into the mindset of producing disclosures, and that if they are challenged by regulators, they find it easier simply to acquiesce and provide the information than to say, no, this is not relevant. And if we're going to change behaviour, we need to do that through some form of symposium or working party that could foster an environment where companies are more willing to remove irrelevant disclosures or not to have them in the first place, and also where they will provide disclosures that are not as specifically required by the standards because they are needed to show a true and fair view. So there'd be value in bringing all the stakeholders that are relevant together there. We also discussed whether there would be value in looking at best practice. HSBC have done a lot to reduce the length of their accounts. What were they doing? What have others done that produce high-quality disclosures that are less verbose, more numbers and fewer words? And like others, we had little support for the notion that smaller listed companies should be treated differently. That's a very quick summary. As like others, very happy if anyone else wants to contradict me or augment that. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard. Any comments or questions of Richard? All right, let's open it up. We have some time remaining. So having heard the report backs of the various groups, seems to be quite a high level of consistency in terms of not seeing a lot of prospect in quick fixes. I think everyone attaching a very high priority that there is a problem, whether it's perception or it's not just or even primarily the quantity, it's as much the quality of what's being disclosed, which is an important issue, but will take time to address, and a substantial part of the solution is a significant change in behavior, which from bitter experience cannot be very well legislated or governed by standards. So a lot of support for, I think, the ISB taking a leadership role and liaising various ways, whether we call it a forum, or perhaps a forum, a number of things may be needed to build on what's being done to date. I think my sense is that people looked at the work that's been done to date and found it useful. Did not sense any appetite for building a distinction based on size. That doesn't mean, I think, that the groups were unsympathetic to solving the problem, but that whatever the solution might be should be of general application, not based on size, per se. Those were some of the points that registered with me, and things like a further implementation guidance on how to apply the concept of materiality, distinguishing items versus information, might be very helpful to people. I invite perhaps Hans, start with you, having heard that, any alarm bells going off?
No, quite the opposite, I must say. I found this an extremely encouraging discussion in two ways. First of all, it is very clear for the very fact that so much work is being done at so many places that the urgency is high. And that urgency has been reinforced by this meeting. So, first of all, I think there is no escaping for us to take this on board. And I think there is also no escaping for us to take this on board quickly. The second encouraging aspect of this discussion was that the common threads, such as were just summarized by you in an excellent way, are also very clear. Everybody knows this is not an easy problem. Nobody says there are easy fixes. Especially look at the concept of materiality and formulate it in such a way that it can be used. And that people's behavior, the looking for safety behavior and disclosing too much behavior, that can change. So I think that is a very important conclusion of this meeting. Isobel Sharp has suggested a couple of times that we would expose her report, which I understand, given all the hard work that has been put into it, and it is a good report. I think that we are probably so close to taking this on board anyway, that what we should do is not inject an intermittent round of exposure of one of these reports. I think we had much better built on all the reports that are being produced right now. Given the fact that there is to a high degree consensus among the reports as well, simply take on board all the good that we can find in these reports and not lose time. Again, I found this, it's one thing when those reports simply appear with an intermittent time of 2 months, three months. It is even much better if you hear it directly from the writers of the report in one session. So I think it was a very useful and inspiring session. Ian, would you like to?
No, I agree with
you, Hans. Hans, my reaction would be similar to yours. Each of the reports is very interesting, but to invite views on one or all of them, it's rather hard, I think, without having that structured approach that I think several of the groups were urging be done. And that would then provide context to drill down to more specifics. But Jerome first, comment?
Yes, thank you very much. I share everything you said, Hans Newport, so I won't repeat it. As much as I get the same feeling as you that there is a clear recognition of the problem and its urgency and no identification of clear solutions and certainly no quick wins, agreed, I continue to have a feeling of unease vis-a-vis the external world. Because if the answer that we give to people, I'm not speaking of small companies, I'm speaking to everyone, is we're on it and we'll deliver a solution in the medium term or in 3-4 years. I mean, that would be effective for you in your day-to-day life in, let's say, a matter of 4 years. As you know, for the business, it's an eternity. So my point is, therefore, and it's very much in the line of what you said too, but I want to insist here, certainly that all those who have worked on these issues should be gathered in a room somewhere and should work together and exchange ideas. Because if they do so, and it struck me during the group discussions and over lunch and again later on today, new ideas pop up. No miracle solutions, but things that can lead to visible results sooner. No fixes, but solutions and positive evolutions. I've heard, in particular, based on the idea that there was a recognition of this behavioral aspect of things, a number of good ideas about guides, statements that could be made to explain how to do things, possible inclusion of elements in a standard, in IAS 1, in whatever document somewhere by the IASB. I mean, some maybe softer things than straightforward standards that could go a long way in improving a situation which is, the more I listen to everyone, much more triggered by unease in application in practice than by anything else. And of course, the standard setter has a role to play in what he says about how to implement, and this has to be taken on by all stakeholders because we all have shared responsibility in that. So that's maybe a new type of approach that is warranted, aside from what is in any case needed, which is really to do something about standards themselves, do the framework exercise, do that in the medium term, reflect long and hard about materiality, etc. But there is also something else to invent here, and I would very much encourage that we do that, because that's the only way to be credible in delivering results. Otherwise, we run the risk of being perceived the other way, of not being able to produce results, and that would be very bad. So, as you see, I'm happy to join that exercise as quickly as possible, because, as everyone has said, but it's not only a word. I mean, there is definitely an urgency here.
Well, Jerome, you make a very good point that to demonstrate the leadership and the urgency, my experience, a very enlightening first step is to get the various players in a room, and it quickly becomes evident that a quick fix is hopeless. And so rather than doing a lot of preliminary research leading up to a grand symposium, there might be some value in sensitizing some of the stakeholders that this, you know, it is being given a high priority, but what one person views as a quick fix is someone else's start of another problem. But have Judith and then Bruce. And another, sorry, I'm missing.
Francois,
thank you.
Thanks, Paul. I was interested in Hans's summary because what I wrote down also was encouraging. And I think it's encouraging the responses we've heard today for two main reasons. Firstly, despite the recognition by everyone that we have a problem here, nobody's calling for a quick fix. And there's a maturity there that perhaps hasn't always been present in standard setting that I've observed. And the second thing that encourages me is that the majority of the groups said, let's use the IASB due process, which, you know, actually exists and it's there and we don't have to reinvent it, and it will, by its very nature, bring in all the stakeholder groups. So I thought our approach to the topic, which has been around for a few years now, has been very encouraging. The bit I'd just like to clarify is that it also fits in very well to what we said about agenda consultation earlier today. And we said when we were talking about agendas that it should go through an evaluation process where there's some research done to see whether it is a issue that the benefits will outweigh the costs, that we're clear who's going to benefit, etc. Now, some of that research has been partially done. It's patchy. You know, we've seen three or four reports today. That needs to be pulled together. But this project, I think, could move fairly quickly through that stage and be a good guinea pig for how that sort of formal evaluation process goes, because it's been started already. So, yeah, encouraging is a very good word, I thought.
Thank you, Judith. Bruce?
Thanks, Paul. I guess the questions I had was, well, just start first off to echo a comment I made in our group where I said that I'm not surprised the financial statements are getting bigger. I mean, if you consider 20 years ago, share-based payments, derivatives, carbon emissions, these weren't issues that we're now facing. So I think we need to take into context that these are there. But the issue I wanted to ask was, you know, if we take a look at the later standards that have come out, and I'll draw mainly on the later ones because of the board members here, these have been through the due process. And I guess the question I wanted to ask is, as much as we're all saying that we're overburdened with the amount of disclosure, what have the comment letters said? I mean, are people coming back on things like IFRS 12, IFRS 13? Are they coming back and saying to you, there's too much disclosure?
I could comment broadly on that. When I came on the board last July, one of my aims was to reduce the amount of disclosures. And if you look at the later standards, revenue recognition, leasing, financial instruments, and insurance, they're full up with disclosures. And I've had a debate at the table, and I mean, some preparers obviously come in saying there's too much disclosure, and then we get users saying there's not enough. And I've tried to debate at each stage whether we need all the disclosures that we're actually proposing. And I've been beaten on every single item. I've been either convinced or outvoted that we do need these disclosures. So it's a really tough point. I mean, you can take the point that maybe standard by standard's not the right way to go, but if you're doing a standard and you're coming across particular situations, you often need disclosures. So it's not simple.
And I could respond, and Canada has a user advisory council. It's composed entirely of people whose day job is professional users, analysts, credit rating agencies, or whatever. And they have discussed this issue on several occasions and I think are very strongly of the view that they're getting too much information that is not at all helpful to their analysis and not getting other information that they deem important. So it's rather than saying it's too long or too short, they're definitely saying it's the wrong mix. It's the clutter issue in part, and with all the clutter, it's difficult for them to isolate the missing bits as effectively. But I don't know that that's coming through in comment letters the way you might otherwise. Françoise, are we?
Thank you, Paul. Well, I wanted to follow up on the point that all the people that have worked so far on the subject should be put in a room together, because I think they're more or less already working. Because I guess we're already working together. I mean, in the FRAG proactive project, FRAG is partnering with the ANC and with the UK ASB, so the clutter, FRC clutter paper, and the ANC thinking are well present in that project. And we, as Mario's presentation has outlined, we've built on the and liaised with the ICAS and New Zealand work in our project. And the FASB has joined forces with us last year. So basically, what we've heard today, the presentation that we've gone through, are already in a group of people that are closely working together. So that I wanted to make a point. I think the other point I wanted to make is that we have presented the way we were heading, meaning to discussion paper. And some parts of that discussion paper may be the same as the one in the FASB paper. Some others may be different. We're not dealing with the same set of gap at present, and that may explain part of it. The other part is that the scope is not exactly aligned, even if it's very similar. But if we have to serve better the interest of this project to modify the next steps, we're happy to coordinate with the ISB and see how we can be more useful.
All right. Well, I think this has been a very worthwhile session. We don't normally take votes, but I'm going to step out on this. I'm not going to ask for a vote, but I have heard no one speak against the importance of this issue or against the proposition that the ISB should take up the challenge of leading this exercise quickly. So if that's a fair observation, we will see that that's, I mean, it's registered very clearly with Hans and Ian, and we'll make sure it's reflected in our report. I would remind us of another role that we play, and that is to sort of, in a communications capacity, to sensitize our stakeholders of important issues. And I think this is one where we could, as a first step, make the point that the concern about disclosure is heard very clearly and is something that is viewed as being a priority item, and steps are being taken. I mean, you have to be careful not to overstate it, but I think that's an important message to get out and about. And for those who think they have solutions, it's time to start sending them in if they haven't already. So I think that's entirely consistent with our role. It's not necessarily advocating a particular result, but rather advocating the need for the a process that has rigor and urgency around it. So I suggest that to you. Finally, on behalf of all the council, I want to thank our presenters for coming and congratulate them for the work done. We wouldn't be at this point if had it not been for the various bits that you have contributed to. It's easy to criticize. I find myself it's much easier to criticize someone else's work than to do the effort myself. And so I think it's a significant accomplishment in its own right. And we just have to make sure that we don't drop the ball on this, and we'll refer to the agenda committee to see at what point it makes sense to bring it back to council. So if that's a fair, I was about to say conclusion, I think it's, for this meeting, it's as far as we can reasonably take it, and in all likelihood that we'll be coming back to it in the not too distant future. All right, then let's move on to the next agenda item, which is a question of how the ISB consults. Who's going to lead off on?
Oops, I'll start, but it's we're going to try and do a conversational piece for you, make it a bit more interesting as we get towards the end of 2 days of hard work. Everybody's had placed in front of them today a How We Consult document, and what I'd like people to do is just to turn to page 3 if you can, and that's how we develop standards. There's a diagram in there that just shows different parts of the process, research paper to agenda decision and so on. What I intend to do is to fill in the gaps, because if anything, it's actually understates significantly the amount of work that goes on behind the scenes and amongst the staff and the board members. It doesn't mention a lot of our due process steps, what we have to do. So what I want to do is we're just going to work through very quickly from the beginning, and at various stages, Hilary and Mark, who are on my left, are going to talk about some aspects of this as well. And what I'm going to try and give you a sense of is a flavour of how the Due Process Oversight Committee has reinvigorated the way we communicate in terms of the board and staff, and at what times we have to communicate to the Due Process Oversight Committee about the steps we've completed. Okay, so if we just start this through it, we don't have very many typical processes. To be honest, only a couple of projects we have on our agenda have actually ever been born as sort of a research process and all the way through. Interestingly, Lisa's is one of them, but not that many actually have been all the way through. So we start to the left and we have our research papers, or I'll just call that a general research mode, and I think that's going to become increasingly more important over time. And we've been doing a lot of thinking internally, and you gave us very consistent feedback yesterday and this morning about how important the networks are of standard setters, of the users, and other people within the broader IFRS community to actually help us collect evidence or data, as it was referred to this morning, to feed into the process. This is even before we add an item to the agenda. And the idea is to make sure that we do understand if it's a broad enough issue, whether or not we understand how deep the issue is, what the potential solutions are, and so on. Now, we have lots of different ways that we do that. We have national standard setters, for example, and there are various acronyms or abbreviations about which particular groups they have. they work under, but we had, you know, the Asian Ocean Standard Setter Group, GLAS through South America, EFRAG through Europe, the individual standard setters. We have a whole range of people that we speak to in different forums that we discuss particular aspects in. Once we've got all the information, and you know, the three-year review that we're just doing now is actually feeding into that process. Once we have enough information, we put together, and we're required to by our due process handbook, a formal agenda proposal. And we are supposed to identify whether or not it meets the agenda criteria. You'll have seen from the matrix we talked about yesterday, there's a possibility that we'll amend our due process handbook to make it a slightly richer assessment. So we've got some sense of urgency, some sense of time, and so on. But we're required to put together a formal proposal setting out how we expect to go ahead with the project. We have to consult with you. It's one of the things we must do, is to speak to you about that. So normally, we will bring to you agenda proposals. The fact that we only we meet only three times a year, we have to think about how we might communicate some of these aspects more quickly, if that's the case, give you a bit more of a background leading up to adding something to the agenda. And that's why SharePoint, for example, has become a very important tool for us. But having placed something onto the agenda through that, what we think is a fairly broad consultation anyway, we actually start the first phase, which is going past the agenda decision. And the sorts of things that we have to do at that stage is we sort of start to put into place the consultative processes. We have to ask ourselves whether we should have a discussion paper. We're required, it's a comply or explain process. So we have to make a decision, the board does, based on staff recommendations, as to whether or not you would get benefit out of having or developing a full or formal discussion paper. Now, we've got some cases that we've had recently, one where the board itself hasn't had a discussion paper, it was an extractive activities. That was a discussion paper put together by standard setters on our behalf. So the board might decide we don't need to actually develop a formal board written or developed discussion paper. That might be enough. If the board decides not to have a discussion paper, we have to inform the Due Process Oversight Committee. It's all done in public, and the DPOC will actually give us any feedback and challenges if they don't think that's the right process. At that stage, we should start thinking about our field work, or field testing as it's currently called. And we have to, again, consider whether we should do field work. And what that often means is going out to individual companies and entities, looking at particular contracts, for example, and seeing how potential solutions to it might be implemented within those particular companies. What sort of systems they have operating. We can use different sort of mechanisms for that, and I'll mention one in a second. But again, if we decide that we don't want to do field work, we have to justify that. Again, you know, staff prepare a paper, the board needs to make a decision to that on that, and we have to communicate with the Due Process Oversight Committee. The same goes with a working group. One of the mechanisms that's very powerful for us is a working group. Working groups have a special meaning for us because they are generally a bunch of experts that we get together, but we actually have to seek endorsement of that group from our trustees. So the Due Process Oversight Committee will essentially look at CVs, look at the backgrounds of the people. They will challenge us and ask, have we got enough geographic coverage? Have we got enough coverage from particular industries, sectors, and so on, to make sure that we've got the right sort of balance within that working group. If we decide not to have a working group, once again, we go through that, we have to explain why not. And generally, it's because the board will decide that it can get that information from other sources. The sorts of things that we've done historically is we've had an expert advisory panel on financial instruments when we had to look at illiquid markets. We've had other expert advisory panels that we have created ourselves, and we've been able to draw from those. So if we think we've got enough bodies out there to actually draw from, then we will decide a working group's not necessary. I'm stunned sometimes at the number of bodies that we do consult with, because we will bring issues back to you. We have our Capital Markets Advisory Committee. It's meeting tomorrow here in London in a public meeting, and that's drawn mainly from the investor community. We have a Global Preparers Forum, which is mainly preparers. We have been examining and assessing whether or not we should have a separate consultative group for what we call mid-caps, to see whether, in fact, there are some issues that affect them disproportionately to others. So we've started to build up quite a wide range of bodies that we consult with. So as we're developing a discussion paper, we'll often, board papers that go to the board will also be taken and summaries to these groups. And that's all leading up to development of a discussion paper. But and probably the most important thing that we do have when we develop these things is that we give a lot of importance to what we call the comment letter process. Because we know that when we put out a discussion paper for comment, we're going to be seeking public comment. However, we have a lot of history and standard setting, and we know if we have a look at who actually sends us comments, it's not always representative of the people we want to get feedback from. And so, as well as having these groups like Capital Markets Advisory Committee, we do a lot of what we call informal outreach, and sometimes more formal as well, to try and supplement that. So Hillary's going to perhaps talk through a few of the types of examples we do, because we anticipate, you know, people, Hillary focuses on investors and users, we anticipate where we might need to sort of reach out and supplement our process.
Okay. Yeah, ideally we would get comment letters from, you know, everybody who's interested, including the user community. But I think it's not realistic for a variety of reasons to do that. One thing that is good, though, is that we often get comment letters from user groups like the CFA Institute or the CRUF or the Investment Management Association and others. And so that gives us some representation of what people, the user community, thinks on a particular issue. We also do other outreach, though, as Alan mentioned, because kind of throughout a project, though. I mean, as an issue comes up, particularly when it relates to a, you know, presentation or disclosure issue, we try to get investor input throughout the process. And so even though we might not be actively seeking their comment letters, or might not be getting comment letters from them at all, we still talk to them. And I think that those open dialogues, you know, having a meeting or a call with one or more investors, maybe a small group of them on the same call, is really useful because it's more informative than a comment letter because you can actually, you know, ask questions and go back and forth and kind of brainstorm a little on things. And it also gives us the opportunity to informally talk about what the proposals are, or what the staff's thinking or what the board's thinking, because when you see it in the exposure draft or in the discussion paper, it's often, you know, quite dry and it's written in very formal language, and so it's much easier when you're talking to people informally to be able to use terms that, you know, most people would understand. We also try to do online surveys, and we're starting to use those more and more. There are benefits and drawbacks of using those, but overall it gives you kind of an idea of what people are thinking on particular issues. And for example, on the agenda consultation online survey that we did for investors, we are doing follow-up calls on some of those surveys. We asked people if they wanted to be contacted, and so for the people who said yes and who seemed to put in a reasoned, you know, thoughtful response, we thought we should get back in touch with them to find out if we can get some more out of them, and people have been very willing to set up those calls, so we're starting those next week. I think that's it from the comment letter or input perspective.
Okay. So, as you see, we do a lot of work. There aren't that many people doing it, so Hillary's quite busy as well. You can imagine, though, so let's say that what we've done now, we've developed all the thinking, the board's gone through the development of all of the technical papers, and it wants to develop a discussion paper. What we're required to do then is that we actually go through a balloting process, and essentially what happens is the board says, right, we've got an idea. We know what the model we think should look like. So a discussion paper itself doesn't contain the accounting requirements in there, but it sets out what we think the right answers are. It's always a lot easier to get consensus around higher level principles than it is around the detail. And so the board will essentially, in a public meeting, give the staff permission to go and start the balloting process. At the same time, the board usually has to reflect back and say, confirm that, right, we did or didn't have a working group, we're comfortable with that decision, and sort of reaffirm it so you can move on. And once the board's actually asked the staff to go and start balloting, it goes into a private process. I'll mention that our review draft process at a later stage, but essentially what happens is that the drafts are prepared by the staff and they go out to each of the board members. They actually have a physical document. We're about to change that so you can have electronic voting, but essentially the board members go through, provide all the feedback they can on the discussion paper, and once the board members are happy with the content that we've got in there, they'll formally vote to release the document. We only need a majority of board members to get a discussion paper out, but essentially once it's out, it's normally out in the marketplace for typically about 6 months for a discussion paper. If we want any shorter, again, normally we'd have to go back to the Due Process Oversight Committee, explain why we wanted a shorter period, but normally it's about 6 months to try and elicit comments. And during that time, we often try to raise much more awareness about what's happening with the project because we want to try and get as many people to comment as possible. So, Mark, do you want to just indication of some of the steps?
Yes, thank you. You may well be aware of a lot of these activities, but perhaps not the thinking behind them. The reason we publish snapshots, which are perhaps the most visible aspect of some of our communications activities, is really an awareness that throughout the consultation process, perhaps within the financial reporting community, there is you're fully aware of the work that we're doing. But really, once you move outside of the financial reporting community, there isn't great awareness of how accounting standards may change in the future. So the theory is, the more we can do to encourage broader participation in the development of the standards early on in the process, the greater the likelihood we've captured the range of views and therefore the higher quality standard that we have, but also the greater the chance that we'll have buy-in to the standard at the end of that process. So the materials that we produce are really trying to explain in as simple terms as possible what it is that the board is proposing, why it is proposing that, and the rationale for the decisions and the thought process that has been through. So when we publish the discussion paper or the exposure draft, we will produce what we call a snapshot document, which is a high-level summary of those proposals. We've been doing snapshots now for a couple of years. We must have done about 10, 15 of them. If you look at the website, more people read the snapshot than they do the actual exposure draft or discussion paper. It's about a factor of 2 to 1, double the number of snapshots are downloaded compared to the actual standards. So I believe they've been successful, but I very much appreciate any feedback that you have. That is just one of the materials that we provide. We also provide slide decks that can be used explaining the proposals, which we are very happy to share with interested parties or the advisory council or with national standard setters. We also go to great lengths to keep people informed of the progress of the project. So in the last few months, we've overhauled the ISB website, so it's easier to keep tabs on the individual projects and to see news related to the development of those projects. We've introduced email alerts, so you can register to receive news related to any particular project. We now have over 200,000 registered users for email alerts. We send out 1.2 million emails a month. It's quite an amazing level of interest. We provide a webcast introduction when we publish proposals. So the day that we announce the proposals, we include a link to register for webcasts. Those webcasts are held in different time zones and are presented by a board member and a staff member to introduce the proposals, again to explain the rationale. And at the end of the webcast, there is a Q&A, so you can ask any questions and that the board member will respond, and that is archived on the website. And we also now do podcast summaries, which are downloadable via iTunes. So if you're working out in the gym and you really want to listen to the exposure draft on IFRS 13, then that may motivate you. But there is a whole series of activities that we're going through to try and encourage broader participation in the standard setting process.
Just remind me again, the podcast, because we do board podcasts as well, board summaries. The number's actually quite high. Do you know how many registrants we've got?
Yeah, there are actually two different types of podcasts. When we publish proposals, we will also publish a downloadable podcast through iTunes that you can listen to that provides a summary of those proposals. After each board meeting, we also record about a 30-minute podcast, which is a summary, high-level summary of the discussions and decisions that took place during that board meeting. It's normally Alan, Steve Cooper, and myself. I think we're up to about 15,000 downloads every month on those podcasts, but they're free of charge. The great thing about podcasts is they take a very short time to record, but they have a wide distribution.
Maybe I need to renegotiate my contract and get it per download. I didn't realize it was, last I heard it was 5, so it's tripled to 15,000. That's 15,000 very sad people in the gymnasiums, I think. Okay, so let's assume that things have gone well. We've got lots of comments back. We then get all the comment letters in. What do we do with them? Because we've had some concerns raised today, you know, is it going to a black hole, for example? And so I'll describe the process essentially that happens with capture of the comment letters. It's a good news story as far as I'm concerned, because about 2 years ago, I suppose, we designed our own data capture system for comment letters. Before that, I guess we had a less formal approach in that individual staff members would actually summarise the comment letters and keep spreadsheets and all sorts. Now what we have is a process in that we have teams of people who do this. We have individuals who will code up each letter, and by coding, they will take a letter and every paragraph is marked up indicating what topic it relates to. And depending on the project, they'll indicate whether it's a favourable or support for something. Some sort of code to help us then find it later. So if you're looking for some sort of letter that deals with acquisition costs, capitalisation or not, whether they're in favour of capitalising acquisition costs or prefer to expense them, we should be able to identify that from our coding. We then have people who take that, capture it into our database. So we actually capture 100% of every letter in an electronic form. So we could, if we chose to, simply print out the letter again as sent to us, or we can slice it and dice it almost any way we want. So we have the ability, and Steve's actually a good one for this because he probably does it more than most people, can sit there at a meeting and sit there and say, well, we actually received 18 letters from the insurance industry, 6 were from North America, and 3 of them said this and 3 said that, so we on a particular issue. So we can actually pull the data up and do that in the analysis. Okay, that's important in terms of just saying when we get the information, we capture everything so it's available for analysis. So it's not just a filtering process. The first thing that happens, and it's very important for us, is we do what we call a comment letter summary. That's quite high level. And the way to think about that is some poor sad person reads all the comment letters and pulls out of that a summary of the general themes, the main things we heard. Hillary will have told us way before we got there from the outreach what those issues are likely to be, and the teams will have built that up. But we get a real sense of what the main issues are, where the main problems or main tensions are, where the main disagreements amongst the constituents and so on. That comment letter summary, our target is to have that at the board table within 6 weeks of the comment period ending. And that means that it's fresh and we get a general picture of a sense of what's going on. At that meeting, we do not ask the board to make any technical decisions. It's normally just, this is what was said. After that, and after developing a plan, we then identify which particular topics we want to do much deeper analysis on. And now we can use our database to go through and pull out of all the information we've got, the messages that we've got from different types of provider, so the different types of comment letters. And so that's when we begin our much deeper analysis, and our paper-by-paper analysis is put together for each topic. We had a look at the leases as a matter of interest, the number of papers. We have, over the last 4 years, the poor old board, well, the staff have written them, the board have looked at something like 300 different papers on different subjects, just on leases alone. And if you think about average is sort of maybe 20 pages, we're looking at 6,000 or 7,000 pages of a staff analysis just on leases. So there's a lot of work that goes on. And we're at the moment just looking at a redesign of our web pages so that we'll be much more accessible in terms of getting to that information. But I just wanted to give a sense of what we do with comment letters, because a lot of people think they just disappear, and they certainly don't. And it means it gives us much more power and ability to go through and identify what users said or preparers said, identify geographical differences amongst preparers versus users and so on. So it's very powerful. Related to that, and I'm just going to jump ahead on a different issue, is we've also been developing, as an extension of that, what we call a database for dealing with stakeholders. It's actually called SID internally. And what we do is that, as well as having our project-related outreach, we are also very interested in having a much broader outreach plan, because not everything relates to projects. And perhaps, Mark, if you can just explain the sort of the general processes we're looking at and our general approach to creating awareness and looking at the stakeholder development.
Thank you, Alan. So, yes, as Alan mentioned, a lot of the outreach and communication that the board undertakes and the staff undertake is project-related. Now, if you have many projects going on at the same time, you have the potential for either duplication in certain areas or gaps in others. So what we're trying to do is take a step back from the pure project-related activity and make sure from a top-down perspective that we are talking to the right people about the right things at the right time. And part of that is making sure that through this database we are able to track our contacts with people who have an interest in following and participating in our work and the standard setting process in general. So we're developing this stakeholder information database, as I say, to ensure that there is end-to-end communication. And we're also looking at supplementing that with a series of processes that ensure that, for example, yourselves as members of the Advisory Council are kept fully up to speed on not only the projects, but other activities that the board is undertaking, or the trustees indeed are undertaking.
I should warn you, if any of you come to the offices or speak to our staff about some projects, and we actually now have the ability, because you're all in the database, we can go through, find out every comment letter you sent to us and pull those up. And it's actually really quite helpful, because I've been along to meetings and the first thing you do is you just go to the database and pull out every comment letter they've sent and quickly go through, and you can get a real sense of flavour and a sense of inconsistency sometimes between the messages you're receiving from people. And we really haven't had as much ability to do that, because we had about 1,000 comment letters, I think, on revenue. And you imagine if you're dealing with 1,000 comment letters, even if it's only 10 pages a letter, that's a lot of material to go through. And again, the database just gives us a lot more ability to do that. So we've analysed, we've gone and started to go through and work through the topics individually. So, you know, as I mentioned to you, we at the end of each of our board meetings, the agenda paper, every paper the staff writes is available for observers to see. You go back 3 or 4 years, we used to call them observer notes, because now and again we would take out some of the staff recommendations, because that was a very strange part of our process. It said that so that the staff can speak freely, we should remove their recommendations from our papers. But that's now disappeared. So every paper that we write, it all goes out into public space and is available for people to see. So you can actually monitor and keep track of the meetings. We've made some internal improvements. I don't want to criticise Hans, it's job reducing thing. When you've got a good controller pushing the buttons, running the meeting with our cameras, it works really well. And we've got the ability now, for those who do watch it from a distance, you don't just see this camera sitting at the back, you actually see two or three faces at a time, and we flick around. And we're looking at making more improvements on that as well. And every one of our meetings, as well as being available to open to observers, sits on our website. We have a lot of space taken up on our website, but every video, we capture basically on video every single meeting, and they stay there. Our retention policy is actually officially forever for any of our due process documents and meetings, so you should be able to go back and review any meeting if you want to. At the end of each day of a board meeting, we do the best we can to get what we call a daily update out, so we will provide updates of all the information for that meeting that we have available, and we follow that up with a full update the following week. So we've improved that over the last about 3 years ago, we introduced that. So we go through a process, then we're going to produce a final standard, for example, and what I'm about to describe we do at the ED phase as well. Again, the board's made all its decisions. It asked the staff to go through a drafting process, and again, we have another consultation that will step in here. We develop what we call a review draft. Some refer to that as a fatal flaw draft, and we will send that out, depending on the project, to somewhere between 10 and maybe up to 30 parties to get their comments and feedback in. And that process takes place before we finalise the standard. So we have quite a bit of feedback that we collect through what we call a fatal flaw review, I guess. We're modifying that slightly, you'll see, for the hedge accounting, because as well as undertaking a targeted review process with selected parties, we're also putting the draft up on our website for 90 days. So in a way, we're making it a very public review process. So we take all that feedback, hopefully everything works well, everybody's happy, we produce a beautiful standard with a basis for conclusions, and then Mark takes over again with more sort of support and documentation.
So the primary document is the project summary and feedback statement, and that really is about closing the feedback loop. There's nothing more frustrating than you providing input to the process and not really understanding how that input was considered by the board. So again, a high-level project summary and the feedback statement is really designed to identify the main themes of the feedback that we heard, to point to the areas where the board accepted that feedback and made changes, and where the board took a different position to explain the rationale for its choice. That feedback statement is then published on the same day as the final standard. It is available to download from our website, and we also send a copy of that feedback statement with a letter from Hans to every person that submitted a comment letter or anyone that participated in a roundtable event, plus other relevant contacts, to make sure that we have done a good job of closing the feedback loop.
How many downloads?
I will check tomorrow. they are widely read, and the purpose is really not only to summarise the feedback, but also to ensure that we've provided a good assessment of the overall life cycle of the project.
And I guess just to close off, the probably frustrating from our perspective is that a lot of what we've told you, you wouldn't see on our website, at least in a succinct or summary fashion at all, because some of it's embedded in our due process handbook, some excellent project pages that we have that explain some of that. But the whole thing, it's quite not a complex process, but it's a very extensive consultation process that we have. And probably the frustrating thing to round off is that it's very hard to communicate this as well. In terms of, we have struggled, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years. We do all this work, we speak to a lot of people, and it's very hard for us to share that as the final wrap-up for a standard. We've had that when we've been putting together our effect analyses and feedback statements for projects recently. We've had cases where, for one of our standards, investment bank came in, some people from it, with examples of the types of documentation that their structuring people use to structure things to avoid our current standards. And they said, this is what you need to write your standard to defeat, essentially. There's no way that we could ever tell anybody which bank that was involved or who the people were, because they came in confidentially to do that. And people are far more open. I think, Hillary, do you find they're far more willing to talk? That we have people who say, well, look, go to the firms, for example, even the big, the major firms, the big six or seven. If you speak to individuals, they're speaking as individuals. They're actually not allowed to speak as if to say, this is the Grant Thornton or the BDO view. They must speak in their own mind. They speak in their own mind. And it's very hard for us to put their name down and say what they said. So what we've been trying to do is identify ways that we can improve the information about how we communicate, who we've communicated with, but in a way that protects them and protects us. And there's always this underlying thing that we're concerned about, and our Due Process Oversight Committee is worried as well, is to make sure that people understand how we picked who we spoke to. Because there's a bit of a worry that people out there think that we pick our friends. So when we tell a good story about a standard or what we heard, it's because we chose who we spoke to. And it is not like that, but it's actually quite hard to demonstrate that without identifying who we spoke to. And, of course, you get back into that problem again. So we are looking to improve how we do that, but any suggestions that you have in your own organisations of communicating in that way be very helpful to know. But I guess I'm reminded, when you share a platform with Hans, I think you He says it's the most transparent organisation, and you can't do anything without doing it in public, that he's been involved with. So it's very hard for us to benchmark in some cases because it's just unprecedented in terms of the transparency. So I'm certainly open to questions and clarify any issues at all.
Comments, questions? Vincent?
Just a question. You had a staff paper. You said you're going to have a staff paper for hedge accounting. And I believe you had a version of the same for the financial statement presentation. Would you have some comments on the guiding principles that dictate when you've got a staff paper?
That's a loaded question in a sense. The issue for the, they were different issues. When the financial statement presentation, there were concerns at the time that it was beyond drafting, in that there were concerns fundamentally about whether what was being proposed would be accepted. In the case of the hedge accounting, the general hedge accounting model, we are putting that out as a draft, seeking drafting feedback. We're not asking fundamentally whether we've made the right technical decisions. It is just a drafting exercise. The financial statement presentation one was the first time we've ever done that, and it was to be honest, to get a sense of whether it would actually work. And the feedback we got was pretty loud, unfortunately, that we had to be very cautious about that project. So decision was made to adjust that stage. But the drafting review that I'm talking about is actually just to get feedback on how well we've actually held the pen, not on the technical decisions. So it's a newer process, and we're building that into our rewrite of the handbook now so that people understand that process.
Any other comments, questions? Well, it's very impressive, and I think you've heard from us time and again that the extra efforts that are being made are appreciated, not always recognized perhaps to the extent one might like. But there is an education challenge for us as well, you know, making people aware of what's available. And certainly in my experience, I've been promoting the snapshots as being, and the feedback statements are the two that I market the most, in the sense of saying, you know, if you have a limited amount of time to allocate to this topic, I find them a very efficient way of keeping a watching brief on the major issues. And it will be an evolving exercise. I'm sure over the years, new and better ways will be devised. But Alan, Mark, and Hillary, thank you very much for providing that update. All right, we have one remaining item, and that is to come back to the discussion we had earlier in terms of the report that we heard in terms of progress to date on the agenda consultation. We then had our own breakouts and report back. And as much as anything, I'm posing a question to the group. You heard my summary of what I thought were the major points coming from the breakout sessions. Are there key messages that you think we ought to be conveying to the board relative to the agenda consultation? I think our issues, if we have any, would relate to process and timing probably as much as the specifics of individual items. But we did want to set a bit of time today to double check to see if there were issues that you thought we collectively ought to be emphasizing at this juncture. Judith.
Just a clarification, Paul. The agenda consultation is part of our charter. Are you proposing to put the summary you gave of our comments that we heard this morning, which were very consistent between the groups, are you proposing to put that in writing to the board? And in making that comment, I acknowledge that we were very, very similar in our comments to the global responses summary too, but is that your proposal?
That is my proposal. I would propose to follow the practice that we've used for the last year and a half or so, where I will post a draft of my report on our website to make sure you're comfortable with what I'm saying. It will try to capture the main points, not all of the specifics. We also, as you may recall, have lately given the discussion leaders of each group the opportunity, two opportunities. One, submit your notes if you haven't already. We will capture the essence of those individual report backs, give the chairs an opportunity to review them, and then they will be posted to our private website. The details would not normally go to the board, but certainly could be if they were felt to be helpful. But so we try and capture the main points in our report. And I just say now I'm looking for any guidance if you think there was something that didn't come out directly in that earlier discussion. Now is the time to raise it. And I guess we don't need to limit it to the agenda discussion. It could be as equally the disclosure discussion that we were just going through. If not, if you're comfortable, I would propose to follow a practice that I think has worked reasonably well. Simply caution you, it does require a fairly rapid turnaround. So my objective would be to have the draft posted within 5 business days, give you a week to comment on it. The reason for that is I think the sooner it gets to Hans and Ian and goes to the trustees as well, the more useful it is to them. So people comfortable with that? All right, then is there anything not on the agenda that members would like to raise at this point? If not, I will adjourn the open session. I would ask members to stay for a few minutes longer in closed session, so I would ask our observers, friends to leave. Thank you for coming. The interest that you show is much appreciated. And also remind people that there is an education session on leasing. But I'm not sure whether we can advance the start time of that. I think we probably can, so